I've been to traffic court in person more than 20 times since August of 2020 to handle citations like driving with a broken windshield or driving with expired registration stickers. Every time I go to court, I spend 1 to 2 hours in unventilated spaces with numerous strangers, where the hallways and the courtrooms are often too small to meaningfully social distance. I am terrified to do this. I'm always thinking of my asthmatic partner of 8 years and what it would be like if my client's broken taillight ticket ended up costing my partner his health or his life.
Lauren Zach, she's an attorney for public counsel, and she does pro bono work in traffic court for teenagers in foster care. She spoke during a press conference this week, part of a group of public service lawyers suing to stop in-person eviction and traffic trials in L.A. County. Just last month, 3 L.A. County Superior Court staff members died of COVID. Hundreds of court employees, including some judges, have tested positive. And there's probably no way to know just how many of the thousands of people who've passed through the court buildings across L.A. County are carrying and spreading the virus. It is a dire situation. We're going to talk about this now with 3 people. Matt Hamilton, reporter for the L.A. Times, who's been following this story closely. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Great, thank you. And Lori Levinson, longtime court watcher, former federal prosecutor, and professor of criminal law at Loyola Law School. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Madeline. Good to talk to you.
Good to have you. And Begonia DeSalvo, she's a Spanish language interpreter at the Criminal Justice Center in downtown L.A. Hi, thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Matt, let's begin with you and just set the scene. In California, there are 2 different systems. There's the federal court system and then this system, the Superior Court system. It's run by the state, but each county has its own. What kinds of cases are they hearing?
I mean, the LA Superior Court system, it's the nation's largest trial court, and they are hearing almost every case as they were before the pandemic. The courts are open for divorces, for small claims cases, for disputes between business partners, and for criminal cases for those who are newly arrested and prosecuted by the DA's office or other prosecuting agencies.
So it can go from a traffic dispute all the way up to murder?
Yes.
So that's a lot of traffic. Begonia, you see the inside of these courtrooms. What does it look like?
It's terrifying. It really is. Because, for example, I started teleworking, luckily, yesterday and today, and I went to get my equipment at Stanley Mosque. And as Matt was saying, all those proceedings were going on, divorce hearings to get the custody of the kids and whatnot. And there are multiple plaintiffs in the courtroom. And you see that it's impossible to keep social distancing. They're at full capacity. And there's mandatory settlement conferences in the UD courtroom that is very, very busy. And yesterday, I took the time to really go there and see, why is this happening like this in person? Why is this not all remote? Because the only thing that is left out are the jury trials in civil and in criminal because of, you know, obvious reasons. But the rest, preliminary hearings that are like mini trials in criminal court, they're still going on. And that's something that federal court is doing remotely. And we can totally do it remotely too. And avoid all that traffic from different mm-hmm. people every day.
Did you know the 2 court interpreters who died?
I work with one of them, Sergio Cafaro. He was another criminal interpreter that was working with me. I worked with him for 4 years, and he was like a family member because we were working together every day. We shared the same lounge space on the 15th floor, and we were really, we all are a very tight group. And this happened just, believe it or not, less than 2 months ago. And that's
so
something that can
you were
be
exposed,
preventable.
I guess. Yeah.
Yes. We were all exposed. We were a group of 17 interpreters that were exposed. And this exposure could have been prevented very, very well, because the interpreter that was exposed in another courtroom was actually in a preliminary hearing courtroom. It's on the 3rd floor of the building. Those courtrooms are completely not ventilated. Lockups are next to them. That's where they bring the defendants. And Sylvia, my colleague, she was the one who was working in one of those courtrooms and got exposed because two people tested positive in that courtroom. And then everybody was sent home to quarantine, and they did not notify her because apparently the person that exposes you needs to name you. That's how they have it right now. So they leave they put the burden on the employees to do their due diligence when really, you know, it shouldn't be that way. She came to work for 4 days straight and exposed us all, 17 of us. And one of them was, unfortunately, Sergio Cafaro, who died in January 12th.
Oh, that's so tragic. Lori, when you hear this, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking it's heartbreaking, devastating, and pretty much unnecessary. And that's what really concerns me. I appreciate that the courts want to get their job done, but we're living in extraordinary times. And as you mentioned earlier, other courts have taken more of a remote approach. Some of these cases, frankly, could be put off for a while and it wouldn't change the universe. We don't have to have a traffic court going. We don't have to have a small claims court going. There are certain things that can be done with the criminal cases to do them remotely. I think there needs to be more of a will to find a different way to handle these matters.
Who is in charge of it? Who has decided that all of these proceedings must take place in person?
Well, the presiding judge of the L.A. Superior Court, that's at least the person who's being sued right now, as you probably know, by public counsel for not having a better approach to this. Because tragically, it's not just the interpreters who are being exposed, but all the court personnel and the public as well. The idea that you have indigent litigants who have to take public transportation, be in a crowded courthouse, be exposed, and those matters can get continued over and over again. So it is the presiding judge of the Superior Court and the other clerk of the court who are being sued.
Matt, can you talk about that? Were you able to talk with the presiding judge, Eric Taylor, and ask him why this is happening?
I was not able to talk to the presiding judge, nor was I able to talk to his predecessor, Judge Kevin Brazil. Both presiding judges have not been forthcoming in their public comments or explaining what the view is from their vantage point. I mean, clearly they're concerned about the backlogs that are building up in the court system. Clearly they're concerned about keeping the business of adjudicating disputes and handling the various claims that run through Superior Court, you know, keeping those on schedule because, you know, the courts just can't simply close and stop operations. It's just not a luxury they have. But I think to Lori's point, the concern that a lot of advocates have is, well, let's have a discussion about what's important and what can be delayed.
Right. So, Lori, is there any concern, any constitutional concern in terms of defendants' right to a speedy trial?
Well, for the defendant's right to a speedy trial, those are being put off on emergency orders, even by the Chief Justice of the state. There is a concern about defendants getting their preliminary hearings, but as been pointed out, those can be done remotely and are being done remotely. I have been in other counties where they have setups from the jail and they're presenting the evidence. They're not doing what we call live prelims in the courtroom because it's just too dangerous for the parties there. Los Angeles, for some reason, has taken a more aggressive approach and just said that we're going to get this done whatever way we have to. It also may be a problem of whether we have the resources for the technology that's needed. But I think all along the way, Los Angeles has been much more lax in the use of its courts during COVID, even to the point where I think judges have been very uncomfortable going to their courtrooms.
Really? So judges themselves don't even want to go into the courthouse because it's unsafe?
Not at all. And when you ask about the constitutional right, that generally is going to go to a right to a trial. There are going to be lots of cases before the California Supreme Court with regard to that. But right now, I think the push to handle civil matters, divorce matters, traffic matters, none of that triggers any constitutional problems.
Begonia, you wanted to say something about the judges?
Yes, I know that many of them are very resistant to technology and change. We all are. But as Lauren was pointing out, these are very, very extraordinary times. And I feel like we just need to jump into the new century, and we need to use the technology we already have and is being used. We just need to expand it, and it will help in the long term with backlog. I totally agree that after this vaccination plan, finishes and we can go back to semi-normal, I do believe that having a hybrid model that do remote and in-person will be the solution for all the backlog. So we need to go remotely in full right now to be safe and make sure that everybody is vaccinated. And, that will be like a mm-hmm. tool that we can use to little by little go back to, the so-called normal.
Right. Well, Matt, what is the situation with the technology? What kind of technology does this court system have? Is it like Zoom or Google Hangout, or is it something else that's kind of more clunky?
So the court has said that every courtroom has remote capability. They use a system called LA Court Connect, which offers both audio and video options to call in or appear on your cases. The way LA Court Connect works is, there is a lot of variety from type of case or from courtroom to courtroom, because sometimes the judge and the parties can decide whether something occurs remotely or not. Sometimes, attorneys or litigants are appearing remotely because they have symptoms, related to COVID-19 and don't want to risk coming into the courthouse. But, LA Court Connect, you can appear on many cases, not all cases, and it's $15 to call in remotely and $23 to appear by video. And that's for both attorneys and for litigants or others appearing on a case. You can secure a fee waiver if you're eligible. For example, if you receive public benefits or if your income is at a certain threshold, you can get a fee waiver, and therefore appearing remotely is free. But many people don't know that or haven't taken the steps to secure the fee waiver.
And also probably some defendants are indigent and they don't have access to this kind of technology.
Correct.
Lori, yes. How is this different in federal court? Do they have a better system for this?
They do have better systems in federal court, and they're not running all of their court proceedings. In fact, they're doing very little in person. Individual judges have tried to call for that, but the chief judge for the district has said there won't be any jury trials and has very much limited it. They have a better system. Frankly, other counties have a better system. I've been on the variety of systems that are available. It may just be because of the cost or the uneven approach, but we weren't ready for this. And a year into it, we're still not that ready technologically for it. But I actually don't think that's the biggest issue. I think the biggest issue is for the court to just put a stop sign up. We need 3 months of a moratorium on more court matters to get people vaccinated, to get the right system in. And then, as said, maybe we go to a hybrid. I do want to say one thing. I don't think you're going to be able to have remote jury trials. That will raise some constitutional issues. But we've had times in our history where we have used literally arenas, Coliseum-type situations to hold jury trials for other reasons. We may have to change some of the venues if we really have to go back to jury trials with distance jurors.
Right. And then there is the whole vaccine issue, and who knows when everyone's going to get vaccinated at this point.
That's right. But I think that at this point, and I read the medical personnel's declarations and affidavits, it is reckless to bring everybody into a courtroom and even pretend that by having plexiglass, we have a safe enough environment for the people who are required to be there and work.
Well, reckless. That is, you could use that in a criminal case.
Well, I hope we never get to that. And again, I'm not ascribing any ill motives. I think that the judges are very much just trying to figure out how to do their job, and they're waiting for the people at the top to say, you're not a slacker if you're really worried right now. And let's find out in the next 3 months if we can all be a lot safer and go back with earnest to handle what will inevitably be a very difficult backlog.
Yeah. So, Begonia, when you go to work, are you afraid every time you walk into the courthouse that you might get COVID?
Well, yes. I mean, I started teleworking officially yesterday afternoon, but I've been working through the pandemic, and every single day that I was coming into the Clara Shortridge Falls Criminal Justice Center, I was terrified because of what I was explaining before, the lockups being in there, you know, the traffic, there's no screening at the door. We were just provided with a simple cloth mask. Inmates are coming with their own handmade cloth mask that they don't even fit. And it's just terrifying. And I was like, we're supposed to stop the spread. We're not, and we're not doing anything. This is too crazy. It's impossible, as Lauren was saying, and reckless. And that's why you need to put a stop to this.
Right. Well, I want to thank you all so much for coming on the show today and highlighting this really important issue.
Thank you.
Matt Hamilton from the LA Times, Lori Levinson from Loyola Law School, and court interpreter Begonia DeSalvo. Coming up, why some Republicans and evangelicals say political violence may be necessary. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. About 40% of Republicans say political violence may be justifiable, even necessary. That's from a new survey released today by the American Enterprise Institute. That think tank asked more than 2,000 American adults if they agreed with this sentence: if elected leaders will not protect America, the people must do it themselves, even if it requires violent actions. About 40% of Republicans said, yeah. The release of the survey coincides with the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, where House impeachment managers have shown new footage of the violent insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th, in which police officers were overwhelmed by a violent mob.
We lost the line! We lost the line! OMPD, pull back! OMPD, pull back up to the upper deck! OMPD, pull back to the upper deck! ASAP!
So, how many people think what happened on January 6th was justifiable? We're joined now by Daniel Cox, who directed that survey from the American Enterprise Institute. Hi.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, your survey was conducted after this January 6th insurrection. What did respondents have to say about that event?
Yeah, well, a lot, it turns out. One of the things that we found was that about half of Americans think that Donald Trump played a role in encouraging the violence at the U.S. Capitol on that day. About a third disagreed, and 14% said that they were uncertain. So that you know, for us suggests that there's a significant number of people, including a majority of Democrats, who think Trump is at fault.
What about for Republicans? What do they say?
Not surprisingly, Republicans take the opposite view. Majority of Republicans say that Trump did not play a role in encouraging the violence at the Capitol.
And did you ask if the violence was justifiable?
Yeah, we had a couple questions we were really interested in getting at, you know, under what circumstances Americans overall, you know, could I imagine, you know, the use of force, the use of violence could be justified. And so we asked, you know, two different questions. One of the ones you cited, and we found about 4 in 10 Republicans said that, you know, if political leaders aren't stepping up and, you know, protecting the country, then, you know, use of violent action could be justified. It's notable, though, that, you know, we asked an agree disagree question, and we allowed people to say whether they completely agreed or mostly agreed. And a much smaller percent of Republicans said they completely agree with that statement. So it suggests there's some sympathy for the idea, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that 40% of Republicans are ready to, you know, storm the Capitol.
Right. And they didn't say specifically whether they approved of that particular storming of the Capitol on January 6th.
Exactly.
Right. So perhaps they would have a different opinion when they saw exactly how it transpired, or were asked exactly how it transpired.
Right. And I think the broader political context is important here. The same, you know, our same poll found that, you know, an overwhelming number of Republicans believe this idea that the political system does not do a good job of representing their views and beliefs and is kind of antagonistic towards it. And then a bipartisan, there's bipartisan agreement among, you know, Democrats and Republicans with this idea that democracy doesn't do a great job of representing the will of the people. It's rather tilted in favor of the wealthy and well-connected.
So most Americans believe that, is your conclusion in the study?
Yeah, so most Americans believe that statement. They believe that, you know, the democratic processes are not working the way they should. And in that context, right, if you're someone who believes that, you know, there's no other recourse and that, you know, the culture and the politics are changing really rapidly away from you, that, I think, creates an environment where, you know, you have these kind of more extreme views become much more attractive.
Hmm. How many people think that the election was illegitimate?
Yeah, so here we see another sharp partisan divide. The vast majority of Democrats and a strong majority of political independents as well say that the 2020 election was legitimate, Biden's win was legitimate. About two-thirds of Republicans disagree. And that actually makes a lot of sense when you look at how many Republicans think that there was a significant amount of fraud in the election, which we asked about as well. And again, a strong majority of Republicans believe, you know, falsely that there was extensive voter fraud in 2020.
So a majority of Republicans believe there was voter fraud?
Yes.
And therefore believe that Biden should not be the president, that his election was illegitimate?
Right, that his election is somehow tainted, it cannot be trusted. And again, I think, you know, given what happened, given there've been 2 months after the election was ostensibly over, when you had Trump not only not conceding, but, you know, trying to detail this massive conspiracy of voter fraud, and doing so in, you know, multiple forums, at speeches, on Twitter. And you didn't have a lot of Republicans rushing out to say, no, Trump's wrong. And I think in that environment, people are, you know, Republicans were trusting that the president wasn't feeding them false information.
Mm. And what about who earns their loyalty or what earns their loyalty? Are they Republicans, the Republicans you surveyed, are they more apt to be loyal to Donald Trump or to the Republican Party in general?
Yeah, this has been an ongoing question when we think about the future of the GOP in the post-Trump era. Just, you know, how loyal are rank-and-file Republicans going to be to Trump versus the sort of institutional party? And for much of the Trump presidency, when this question was asked, we weren't the first ones to ask this question, the bulk of Republicans said they sided more with Trump than the institutional GOP. But that started to change over the last few months. And in our poll, we found about 6 in 10 Republicans saying that they sided, their loyalty was more with the Republican Party than with Trump. And I think you're going to see more polls turning that up as well.
Well, that's interesting. So that does suggest he has a waning hold on the party as he's out of office.
Yeah. And I think there's a good question, which I've had with many of my colleagues, you know, to what extent has Trump already transformed the GOP? So, you know, his presence isn't really needed. He doesn't need to be cajoling or threatening other Republicans to kind of fall behind him, because Trumpism has now kind of seeped into the GOP, you know, in a way where you see people, half the Republicans in our sample said that Antifa was largely responsible for the violence of the Capitol. And so embracing these ideas, these claims that are false.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of, how many Republicans in your survey believe in the QAnon conspiracy theories?
This one was a really interesting question. So, you know, there's been a lot of polls on QAnon, and we've asked about it before as well. And I think there's a lot of Americans who haven't really heard of it, or, you know, are not all that familiar. And so when you ask about QAnon, you get, you know, roughly around, you know, no more than half the country sort of saying they're familiar with it. So we didn't want to ask about the actual theory. We said, well, what if we unpack it and just, you know, provide people with the actual statement of, you know, what is this theory? And there's no one theory about QAnon, but by and large, an important part, a central part, is that Donald Trump has been secretly fighting a child sex trafficking ring that includes prominent people on the left. And so we just laid that out there and said, you know, is this claim accurate or not? And close to 3 in 10 Republicans said that claim is completely or mostly accurate, which was a lot higher than I think we were expecting.
Wow. So almost a third?
Yeah.
So that does show how this theory, this conspiracy theory, QAnon, has seeped into mainstream Republican thought.
Yeah, and I think again, it's helpful to step back and just look at the changing media environment, our social environments, which play a role in all this. You know, conspiracy theories have been around a long time, I think it's only in more recent years when we see them really take off and kind of seep into the mainstream. And I think partly social media is to blame, right? It these theories become so much more accessible. You don't need to go on 4chan or 8chan or down a Reddit rabbit hole. This stuff is showing up on Facebook, and your neighbors or your distant cousins are posting about this stuff, and so you're seeing it more often. The other thing is that we found in our work that people are not only in media bubbles, right? So consuming only media on the left or the right, but they're actually socially segregated from people with different political views than their own. A majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats count only members of their own party in their immediate social network. And that plays a huge role as well. And we found in our study that people that are isolated from those with different political views are much more likely to embrace conspiracy theories.
Daniel Cox, director of the Survey Center on American Life at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
Coming up, the director of the new movie Little Fish is here. It's a love story set during a pandemic.
I do feel like there's optimism in the message that focusing on love and our loved ones is how we get through tough times. I view it as a sort of love conquers all.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the new sci-fi film, Little Fish, the world is facing a devastating pandemic. Not the same one we're living through right now, but it's kind of close.
There's chaos all around us. People freaking out looking for cures. We're losing our friends. You're losing your mom. Borders are sealed. Flights are grounded. And people are getting lost on their own streets.
Unlike COVID, the disease in Little Fish causes people to lose their memory. Young and old, it can happen all of a sudden or gradually. The film calls it neuroinflammatory affliction, or NIA. Little Fish is also a love story, as newlyweds Emma and Jude, played by Olivia Cooke and Jack O'Connell, face an illness that threatens their memories of each other. Joining us now is the film's director, Chad Hartigan. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you filmed this pre-pandemic back in 2019, and why was this an intriguing idea for you to base this movie around the idea of a pandemic?
Well, I first read the script in late 2018, and at that time, my girlfriend was pregnant with our first child, and so there was a lot of love and joy and optimism within my own house, and yet at the same time, it felt like the news from the outside world was always bad. And the news, if you turned on the news, it was about children locked in cages at the border or only 10 years left to address climate change, etc. And so I really related to the idea of a couple having to just sort of cling on to themselves and focus on their own love at the expense of a crumbling world around them, and that would be the only way to have optimism about the future. And that really resonated with me, and I felt like it was something I could capture. So that's what drew me to it, and now, of course, those are feelings that are much more universal.
Right, and so how are you looking at your movie now in this current context?
Well, it's difficult. It's really hard to imagine what it must be like to watch it for the very first time now, because I of course saw it so much before the pandemic and saw it as one thing, and now no one else is seeing it that way. So I have to admit, I was nervous at first, and a few months went by at the start of the pandemic where I really just was too nervous to even think about watching it. But then in August or so, I had to, and was relieved and surprised to find that it actually played the best for me it ever played. And then I started to feel more comfortable with the idea that maybe actually the pandemic was going to put people in a state of mind that maybe they'd be more receptive to this type of story of love and getting through unprecedented times together.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it could have been, I mean, you could have approached this topic in a lot of different ways, like a thriller or an action film, and you didn't. Like, the pandemic is kind of, I mean, obviously it's the driving element, but it's not really about the pandemic. It's about this relationship. So did you wrestle with that decision? Like, how exactly should I put more of the sort of typical pandemic type scary stuff in there?
No, that's actually one of the other things that drew me to it originally, was that I thought the script was really smart in that it both told the full story of a complete relationship via small moments, and it also told the full story of a global pandemic happening outside via small moments. And that I thought was both really smart and also another fun cinematic challenge to tackle. So I think that is also what's kept it from feeling already immediately dated by the real pandemic. There wasn't so much focus on it, so there wasn't so much that we could get wrong.
Right. I want to play a clip of tape of Emma realizing that Jude has the disease. And here she is talking to him. She works in a vet's office, and a lot of the dogs in the office have to be euthanized, and so she wants to bring one home. And here is their conversation.
It's a shame we can't take some of them. The dogs. I mean, they've been putting down so many recently.
Huh?
Yeah, just like a puppy or something. I'm sure Blue wouldn't mind. What?
You said we couldn't.
When?
We had an argument about this last week, and then we were just about to get into it again on the bus.
Can you talk about how you decided to make that the moment where she realizes he's got the disease?
Well, we just thought that it needed to be something mundane, and it needed to be just a quiet moment between the two of them, and they're making dinner together, and we've established their relationship as being sort of, you know, romantic and sweet, and then to just out of nowhere, he would just say something, and that would be the clue. And we also like the idea of, you know, people forget things all the time, and people's memories, even healthy people, are unreliable. And so we wanted to kind of toe that line of like, is he really afflicted, or is this just an innocent mistake? And we thought if it was too big and too grand, that it sort of diminishes the dramatic value.
Mm. Right. And so it's also a commentary, your movie, about what makes a relationship. And what makes a relationship is memories, and often memories of things that you did together, or memories of moments that you shared together, or you know, significant moments where your relationship took hold, you know, like where they first met, or the first kiss, or their first argument, or whatever. Like, all of that is what makes up a romantic relationship. And so when you don't have that, then what do you do with your relationship? Do you still have a relationship?
Yeah, there's the line she has where she says, "What were we even trying to save? Our experiences together, is that all I love about him?" And that really did jump out at me as something that was worth exploring. And so I started to wonder about my own relationships. And yeah, you reach a point when you're in them long enough that when you have a chance to really sit down and talk and you end up having a good night making each other laugh, it's usually because you're remembering some other fun thing that you did together, not having a brand new conversation.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess it's also interesting because when you think of people losing their memory and caring for a loved one who's lost their memory, you're usually thinking of an older person, someone who has dementia or Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And
when we think of those people, we say, oh, it's a shame that they can't remember. But we never think about the future that it's robbing them of, because we think of them as being close to the end of their life. But when you're forced to realize that not having memories also inhibits you from building anything new or having a future, I thought that was really effective as well.
Yeah. But I have heard from people who take care of people with dementia or Alzheimer's that there's also a freeing aspect of it. Like, you're forced to live in the radical present. Like, you don't have memories bogging you down or past grievances or, you know, memories of hurt feelings and things like that. So it can also be freeing and a beautiful thing in some cases.
Yeah, and I think that Mattson, the writer, was probably trying to lean into that a little bit when we get to the latter stages of the film and she stops really feeling like she can cure him necessarily and just gets down to the nitty-gritty of, like, day-to-day, getting through each day as best as possible, which is a common narrative in people with, like, new disabilities.
So did you see it also as a commentary on how we handle aging and handle these diseases? Because often we shut old people up and separate them so we don't have to deal with it. We don't have to think about it. We don't have to be faced with this issue.
I didn't truthfully do a lot of research into Alzheimer's just because I wanted to make sure that I was treating this like a fictitious movie disease, which it is. And I knew that there would be parallels to Alzheimer's or dementia, and it's referenced in the movie, but definitely wanted to not be insensitive to those real diseases and the people that are dealing with those real diseases. And so really wanted to just keep it in the realm of fiction and have it be its own thing.
And so you said that you read this when your girlfriend was pregnant. Well, I guess you now have a little kid.
I do. Yes.
So you're creating, like, she's starting all, or he, I don't know, he or she?
He, it's a boy.
He, okay. So he is, he's like 2 or 3?
He's 2, he's almost 2. Yeah, and of course I'll always associate this movie with him. He was born on the first weekend in between our first week of shooting and our second week of shooting. So right in the middle of production, he was born and made it, you know, a sleep-deprived shoot for sure. But there was so much joy on that set, and it was a life-changing time for me. And I was very lucky to be able to work on this movie at that time and make it happen. And now I feel like, yeah, he's always tied to it, and it's always tied to him.
Well, do you think the movie is optimistic?
Yes, I felt that way from the beginning. I feel like I'm an optimistic person, and so that's one of the things that I became nervous and curious about once the pandemic hit, if that was still going to come across, or if it was just going to be too sad for these times. But I do feel like there's optimism in the message that focusing on love and our loved ones is how we get through tough times. But yes, I view it as a sort of love conquers all.
Well, Chad, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much.
That's Chad Hartigan. He's director of Little Fish from IFC, and it's available now in select theaters and on video on demand platforms. Coming up, why Dana Point in Orange County is home to maybe the world's best whale watching. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, the harbor off the city of Dana Point in Orange County is a hub for sea life. And that's because the harbor is a protected marine area, and it's a place where gray whales, humpbacks, orcas mingle with many different dolphin species on the annual migration to Mexico from Alaska. And you don't have to venture far from the coast to see this wildlife. It is also, this area, the first whale heritage site in the United States. The designation comes from a nonprofit conservation group called the World Cetacean Alliance. That's based in the UK. And the organization's goal is to highlight places with responsible and sustainable whale and dolphin watching programs. Only three other places in the world share that title. And Dana Point's success is all because two rival whale watching companies decided to work together to make it happen. And joining me now are the heads of those companies, Donna Kales and Giselle Anderson. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with setting the scene. You two operate two different whale watching companies. And so you were rivals for a while. What did that look like?
Probably just like any other rivalry, you know, we both, I think the difference is that at that time, you know, we both obviously put our own companies first, and we still continue to do that, but we have really recognized the benefits of promoting Dana Point as the dolphin and whale watching capital of the world, you know, a designation that we always knew, but being able to come together and do that has been so much more beneficial for both companies.
When did you decide to do that, to come together and do that? What was the animating event that led you to decide, you know, let's do this. Let's drop this competitive stance and work together.
I think that, Giselle and I, like, we both have been promoting our businesses, hers being Captain Dave's Dolphin Safari and mine being Dana Wharf Sport Fishing and Whale Watching. We had both been doing that, you know, promoting Dana Point as the place to go see dolphins and whales, and it's the best place in the world. But we were at a tourism meeting, and we came together and we started talking about what makes Dana Point so special. Giselle told me about all her travels. I compared notes with her, and that is kind of like, we just kind of had an epiphany moment, right, Giselle? Like, we were like, oh my gosh, we have to do this. We've been going against each other for so long, but together we can accomplish it.
Was that hard though? Because you had been rivals for so long, was it hard to do that, to make that pivot?
You know, I think that it wasn't as hard as it could have been, because I would like to, at least I can speak for my perspective, it wasn't an ugly rivalry. I think there was mutual respect involved in our rivalry. It was never personal. So it wasn't as hard as it could have been. You know, I think that there are some rivals who it would be really tough to see them come together. But for us, it wasn't as difficult. And I had a crystallizing moment as well. There was that. And then when Dave and I travel, we go to different places around the world and to see dolphins and whales. And we had seen again and again, you know, we would go to these hot spots that were supposed to have just, you know, all that and more. And we would get there and I would think, this is not as great as what we have. And the things that separate us are, for instance, you can go to some destinations and they'll have whales, but only seasonally. And so you can only go for a short period of time. Or they'll have whales, but the weather precludes you from being able to go any time of year. Or they'll have dolphins, for instance, and perhaps, you know, they'll be excited about a pod of dolphin that's 50 to 100 strong. And for us, our average size pod is several hundred, and we see megapods of 1,000 or more on a weekly basis. And we see pods as big as 10,000, and we have a population of dolphin that's over 450,000 dolphin in just one species. So when it comes to dolphins, Southern California is hands down the best place in the world to come and see them. And then we've got year-round whales as well. We have five species of whales, and Donna can, you know, tell you more about them.
Right. So, and I would also say that the dolphin stampede made famous in Dana Point. So there's just a lot of things that have been going on for a really long time. We do see blue whales, fin whales, gray whales, humpback whales, and minke whales. Right now, we're celebrating our gray whale season. That's really what made Dana Point famous. Gray whales migrate past Dana Point. We have a referenced landmark called the Dana Point Headlands. It's a high point in Dana Point. Whales go out towards Catalina, and they make a beeline to the Dana Point Headlands. And from there, they continue their travels down to Mexico. So there's so many unique aspects of Dana Point, and we are uniquely positioned to be the dolphin and whale watching capital of the world. And that's really what started Giselle and I on the journey. We wanted to trademark Dana Point as the dolphin and whale watching capital of the world. And we didn't know that it was going to be a hard thing to do. And we just did it. And so it was really amazing. But that was our first thing that kind of led us to know that we can do this, and we can make Dana Point a dolphin and whale watching destination.
What is it like now? So if you get on a boat and go out, how quickly will you see a whale and lots of dolphins?
Right. So right now is an amazing time to see gray whales. It's the yeah. peak, mid-February through mid-March is the peak of the migration. So we see them still coming south on their way to Mexico, where they have their babies and do their mating. And then we see them coming back. So they're starting to see, we just started seeing northbound whales. So you can see whales from shore. So you don't have to go far at all. And then the thing that makes Dana Point unique compared to other harbors along the Southern California coast is that we are very close to these very deep coastal canyons where the very cold water is, and where you have this super cold water, you have nutrient rich water, nutrients up well, and then you have smaller fish, and then you have bigger animals feeding on them. And so we can be in the middle of a dolphin pod of 1,000 or 5,000 within a mile of shore. And we don't have to go far out to get to these deep coastal canyons. We can just, you know, zip right out there and be out there in 5 minutes. So it's very unique to Dana Point.
It sounds like you two have really buried the hatchet, and that is a good thing for everyone, not just the two of you. So thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having us, Madeline. This has been so fun.
Yes, thank you for recognizing Dana Point and everything that we've accomplished.
Donna Kayla is co-president of Dana Wharf Sport Fishing and Whale Watching, and Giselle Anderson is vice president at Captain Dave's Dolphin and Whale Watching Safari. All right, that does it for us today. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.